Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. So maybe you've been stuck at home for a while now, and maybe you're running out of things to do. If you've already baked 3 sourdough loaves and watched everything currently available on Netflix, or if you just need a break from the stress, we have a suggestion. 36 Questions to Fall in Love. First, listen to Gillian Jacobs reading Mandy Len Catron's essay, To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. Then, if you feel like it, try the 36 questions with someone. You can find a link to all of the questions at wbur.org/modernlove. Then, send us a voice memo telling us about your experience. Did you discover something new about the person you did this with? Were there any questions that particularly struck you? Did the questions lead to love? Email us your voice memo at modernlove@wbur.org. Now here's Gillian Jacobs with Mandy Len Catron's essay.
More than 20 years ago, the psychologist Arthur Aaron succeeded in making 2 strangers fall in love in his laboratory. Last summer, I applied his technique in my own life, which is how I found myself standing on a bridge at midnight, staring into a man's eyes for exactly 4 minutes. Let me explain. Earlier in the evening, that man had said, "I suspect, given a few commonalities, you could fall in love with anyone. If so, how do you choose someone?" He was a university acquaintance I occasionally ran into at the climbing gym and had thought, "What if?" I'd gotten a glimpse into his days on Instagram, but this was the first time we had hung out one-on-one. "Actually, psychologists have tried making people fall in love," I said, remembering Dr. Aaron's study. "It's fascinating. I've always wanted to try it." I first read about the study when I was in the midst of a breakup. Each time I thought of leaving, my heart overruled my brain. I felt stuck. So, like a good academic, I turned to science, hoping there was a way to love smarter. I explained the study to my university acquaintance. A heterosexual man and woman enter the lab through separate doors. They sit face to face and answer a series of increasingly personal questions. Then they stare silently into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. The most tantalizing detail? 6 months later, the 2 participants were married. They invited the entire lab to the ceremony. "Let's try it," he said. Let me acknowledge the ways our experiment already fails to line up with the study. First, we were in a bar, not a lab. Second, we weren't strangers. Not only that, but I see now that one neither suggests nor agrees to try an experiment designed to create romantic love if one isn't open to this happening. I Googled Dr. Aaron's questions. There are 36. We spent the next 2 hours passing my phone across the table, alternately posing each question. They began innocuously. "Would you like to be famous?" "In what way?" And, "When did you last sing to yourself? To someone else?" But they quickly became probing. In response to the prompt, "Name 3 things you and your partner appear to have in common," he looked at me and said, "I think we're both interested in each other." I grinned and gulped my beer as he listed two more commonalities I then promptly forgot. We exchanged stories about the last time we cried and confessed the one thing we'd like to ask a fortune teller. We explained our relationships with our mothers. The questions reminded me of the infamous boiling frog experiment, in which the frog doesn't feel the water getting hotter until it's too late. With us, because the level of vulnerability increased gradually, I didn't notice we had entered intimate territory until we were already there, a process that can typically take weeks or months. I liked learning about myself through my answers, but I liked learning things about him even more. The bar, which was empty when we arrived, had filled up by the time we paused for a bathroom break. I sat alone at our table, aware of my surroundings for the first time in an hour, and wondered if anyone had been listening to our conversation. If they had, I hadn't noticed. And I didn't notice as the crowd thinned and the night got late. We all have a narrative of ourselves that we offer up to strangers and acquaintances, but Dr. Aaron's questions make it impossible to rely on that narrative. Ours was the kind of accelerated intimacy I remembered from summer camp, staying up all night with a new friend, exchanging the details of our short lives. At 13, away from home for the first time, it felt natural to get to know someone quickly. But rarely does adult life present us with such circumstances. The moments I found myself most uncomfortable were not when I had to make confessions about myself, but had to venture opinions about my partner. For example, question 22. Alternate sharing something you consider a positive characteristic of your partner, a total of 5 times. And question 28. Tell your partner what you like about them. Be very honest this time, saying things you might not say to someone you've just met. Much of Dr. Aaron's research focuses on creating interpersonal closeness. In particular, several studies investigate the ways we incorporate others into our sense of self. It's easy to see how the questions encourage what they call self-expansion. Saying things like, I like your voice, your taste in beer, the way all your friends seem to admire you, makes certain positive qualities belonging to one person explicitly valuable to the other. It's astounding, really, to hear what someone admires in you. I don't know why we don't go around thoughtfully complimenting one another all the time. We finished at midnight, taking far longer than the 90 minutes for the original study. Looking around the bar, I felt as if I'd just woken up. That wasn't so bad, I said. Definitely less uncomfortable than the staring into each other's eyes part would be. He hesitated and asked, Do you think we should do that, too? Here? I looked around the bar. It seemed too weird. Too public. We could stand on the bridge, he said, turning toward the window. The night was warm and I was wide awake. We walked to the highest point, then turned to face each other. I fumbled with my phone as I set the timer. Okay, I said, inhaling sharply. Okay, he said, smiling. I've skied steep slopes and hung from a rock face by a short length of rope, but staring into someone's eyes for 4 silent minutes was one of the more thrilling and terrifying experiences of my life. I spent the first couple of minutes just trying to breathe properly. There was a lot of nervous smiling until, eventually, we settled in. I know the eyes are the windows to the soul or whatever, but the real crux of the moment was not just that I was really seeing someone, but that I was seeing someone really seeing me. Once I embraced the terror of this realization and gave it time to subside, I arrived somewhere unexpected. I felt brave and in a state of wonder. Part of that wonder was at my own vulnerability, And part was the kind of weird wonder you get from saying a word over and over until it loses its meaning and becomes what it actually is, an assemblage of sounds. So it was with the eye, which is not a window to anything, but rather a clump of very useful cells. The sentiment associated with the eye fell away, and I was struck by its astounding biological reality. The spherical nature of the eyeball, the visible musculature of the iris, and the smooth, wet glass of the cornea. It was strange and exquisite. When the timer buzzed, I was surprised and a little relieved. But I also felt a sense of loss. Already I was beginning to see our evening through the surreal and unreliable lens of retrospect. Most of us think about love as something that happens to us. We fall. We get crushed. But what I like about this study is how it assumes that love is an action. It assumes that what matters to my partner matters to me because we have at least three things in common. Because we have close relationships with our mothers. And because he let me look at him. I wondered what would come of our interaction. If nothing else, I thought it would make a good story. But I see now that the story isn't about us. It's about what it means to bother to know someone, which is really a story about what it means to be known. It's true you can't choose who loves you, although I've spent years hoping otherwise. And you can't create romantic feelings based on convenience alone. Science tells us biology matters. Our pheromones and hormones do a lot of work behind the scenes. But despite all this, I've begun to think love is a more pliable thing than we make it out to be. Arthur Aaron's study taught me that it's possible, simple even, to generate trust and intimacy. The feelings love needs to thrive. You're probably wondering if he and I fell in love. Well, we did. Although it's hard to credit the study entirely, it gave us a way into a relationship that feels deliberate. We spent weeks in the intimate space we created that night, waiting to see what it could become. Love didn't happen to us. We're in love because we each made the choice to be.
Gillian Jacobs, reading Mandy Len Catron's essay, To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. Gillian told us afterwards why she chose this story.
I have an increasing interest in science, which has taken me by surprise. And so I thought that this essay gave an interesting insight into the biological and scientific reasons behind love, and is also kind of squishily romantic at the same time.
Romantic for sure, especially the looking into each other's eyes for 4 minutes part. But is Mandy still in love with this guy? We'll find out after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript with the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones, and the author of this week's essay, Mandy Len Catron.
You know, I was very nervous in the week before the piece was published, and I actually stayed up super late one night Googling other people who had had articles published in Modern Love and what the reception had been. And I remember the next day saying to my partner, all I want is just like not to have to go on the Today Show. And then the piece came out, and suddenly, like, I think within an hour, my sister was texting me and saying, people who don't even know you are sharing this on Facebook. And then literally the next morning, the Today Show called. And I was like, oh no.
If someone were to ask what is the most fun I've ever had in publishing a Modern Love essay, it would have to be this one. Mandy Lynn Catron's essay sort of blew the doors off the column when it came out and went viral in a way that nothing in Modern Love had done to that extent, and that really few stories published anywhere ever do. It led to an episode of The Big Bang Theory where the characters in the sitcom were asking each other the questions. It led to several documentaries where people were summoned to warehouses and paired up and filmed exchanging the questions. I wish I had statistics on couples that have resulted from it, but I know of at least a few that where the people contacted me directly. And not long after the essay came out, Mandy herself and her relatively new boyfriend were out having pizza, and her boyfriend typed something onto his phone and slid it across to her, and it said, the people next to us are doing the 36 questions. And she looked up and looked over and listened, and sure enough, in their own pizza parlor, they'd inspired this couple to do the 36 questions. So it was just sort of a steamroller, and it went worldwide.
So I think one of the important things to keep in mind about the 36 questions is that actually they've been used in a lot of different research, and really interesting research that has nothing to do with romantic love at all. So when Arthur Aaron first published these, he just wanted to see if he could create a sense of closeness between two strangers over the course of 90 minutes. I didn't think about it as like a life-changing experience. And I didn't think, oh my God, we're going to fall in love now. You know, I just thought like, wow, that was fun. And it was meaningful. Like it felt like a really great way to get to know someone quickly. And I felt like we were really close and that we would continue to stay close. And I had no idea what form that intimacy would take, whether we would be really good friends or whether we would start a romantic relationship. It wasn't like we just fell in love over the course of the evening. We really actually just developed a really intimate friendship, and actually the relationship became more serious and more romantic about 3 months later. So we are still together, which I know people are like dying to know. I almost feel like the fact that we're still together kind of oversells the power of the 36 questions, because I think people want it to be this guarantee that you can fall in love and find this life partner and that you're going to be really happy together. And so far, that has been my experience. But to me, like, the real value of these questions is not as a tool to fall in love, but actually just a way to find intimacy with someone. Because I think ultimately, like, we all just want to be known.
You know, to fall in love, obviously, you need to make yourself vulnerable to the other person. And the brilliance of this approach is how it gives you sort of a game to play. And everybody wanted to try it, except me. I have to say, I have not done this with my wife yet to fall in love again or whatever, to get to know each other better. But I have heard about a lot of married couples, not married that long or married decades, who did these questions. And they said that these were never things they had discussed in 25 years of marriage. So that was this really sort of refreshing side effect to this essay, is how you can use them on someone who you you know, who you've been with a long time, even though you may not know them as deeply as you think.
Thanks to Modern Love editor Daniel Jones and Mandy Len Catron, author of To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. She's also the author of a collection of essays called How to Fall in Love with Anyone. Special thanks to Gillian Jacobs for reading Mandy's story. She's best known for her roles in the Netflix series Love, HBO's Girls, and NBC's Community. And just a reminder that you can find the link to the 36 questions at our website, wbur.org/modernlove. And if you try them, or if you've ever done them before, send us a voice memo telling us about your experience. Send it to modernlove@wbur.org. It might be included in a future episode. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. This episode was originally produced by Amory Sievertson. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. We're edited by Catherine Brewer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional thanks to Mia Lee, Julia Simon, and Anya Stremian at The New York Times, and Paul Kahlo at WBUR. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.